Welcome once again to Left Turn Canada, the leftist podcast where myself, Andy Burkowski, and my co-host, Christo Evelise, try to tackle a lot of the Canadian issues that are normally dealt with by perhaps the mainstream media, right-wing media, and don't really give that perspective that, you know, we're looking for, that a lot of us feel. So, Christo, thank you so much. How are you doing today, buddy?
Doing great. How about you?
I am getting ready for a new lockdown, so that's pretty exciting. Yeah. That's a little bit of breaking news right before we're recording, but I do have some good news since we are all going to be locked down together in Ontario, at least for the next 30 days. I have some exciting news. We are starting our Patreon officially. As you're hearing this, you should be able to access our Patreon at patreon.com/leftturncanada. Just type that in. It'll go right to the page there. And we're really excited because this is about what we wanted to do with the show. It was really about creating something that could be real grassroots, have that connectivity with you all that are listening, and you know, create something that is really for all of us. So we're starting with the very basic three-tier method, not expecting a lot, of course, only give what you can. At that initial tier of the $5 a month, if you're familiar with Patreon, that's how it works. Basically, you're subscribing monthly to support the show. You get early access to the episodes, Discord access where we talk about the episodes, what we're going to, you know, be discussing that day. A personal thank you from either of us on that donation and that continued support, because it really does mean a lot. And if we are ever in a position where we have ads, you won't hear any of those. The second tier, as you may have guessed, $10, a little bit more. Again, only if you can. There's a lot of great programs out there, so don't overextend unless, you know, you're able to. One of the big features here that I'm excited about, it's all the other stuff that we said, the Discord, the early access, but actually having questions read live on air on the show, or even playing an audio clip to really get you involved. Yeah.
Whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, some people might want to send in a clip, some people might not, but yeah, you know. Within reason, if you want us to to read a question, why is Doug Ford so handsome?
Yeah,
we're gonna need at least $50 for that.
Yeah, no, I'll talk about that if you want to. I'll get into that, but it's gonna be cool because I think this is one of my more exciting features. Blah, words today. Because I really do like the idea of having more direct contact with all y'all that are listening and making this you know, something that we can do weekly, feel confident about. And then finally, we have the $20 and above tier. So again, only if you can. And this is, you know, a great contribution that we really do appreciate. You're going to have access to a lot of behind the scenes stuff with that, how we create the show, the ideas that go into that, one-on-one chat with either of us about, you know, what's important to you, you know, what do you think the show should be about, and of course some free swag clothing. We're going to try to get, you know, something really simple, something really easy, but just something to show you that we appreciate you giving your hard-earned money to us to develop this sort of content. So check it out again, patreon.com/leftturncanada. Anything else, Christo, that I missed? It's very possible, but I think that's pretty much it.
No, I mean, we're setting up this Patreon to help us, you know, do the best podcast we can. And, you know, we want to keep the podcast free to everyone because we want to be able to spread a message, you know, for the left, of the left, by the left in Canada. And, you know, this would help us, you know, with our core fans, people that really believe in the message, you not only get more of us, but also help find new people, find us and help maybe change some things in this country.
Yeah. And I think it should be said, I think Christo might have touched on it there, that if you aren't able to contribute, you're still getting the show. We're not going to have one episode locked away, two episodes a week sort of thing. You know, you'll definitely get all access. This is just for people that want to be a little more involved and have the ability to. So please check that out. I hate asking for this sort of stuff, but it's really cool. Like, maybe you can speak to this too, Christo, but I have gotten, just talking to some really amazing, you know, young, strong-willed Canadians after starting this show, and like what is upsetting them and how, you know, hearing people talk about it is so vital. So I've loved it, man. It's been great these first six episodes.
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun. I think, like, I've known a little bit more of the people being traveling in these circles a little bit longer, but it's been fantastic, and you know, people have had tons of great things to say about the podcast, so we're happy to keep it going.
Yes, indeed, and keep it going. We shall. We talked about this the last few weeks, a new segment that we are trying to begin here. Basically, we're looking for the worst politicians in Canada. So we want the people that are ruining your life, the people that maybe we're not aware of, maybe we are, that are doing things that are just tangibly making your life worse. And this week we wanted to start with an all-star. We got some votes in the last week. Please, you know, keep sending those either to Twitter or email lefturncanada@gmail.com. most of them honestly were for Justin Trudeau. I think there are five or six that were all just pretty plain and simple: Justin Trudeau is the guy. But today I want to talk about a heavyweight.
He will be in 1 week.
What's
that? We're gonna hit Trudeau, but not this week. This week there's bigger hitters.
Yes,
bigger hitters this week. Yeah,
we got someone big, and yeah. So why don't we do drum roll, please?
We need people to be vigilant, and you know, a lot of people let their guards down. And I think, you know, you walk down the street in your area, and the patios were packed. And all of a sudden, this variant took place, and the virus took off.
Yes, indeed. It is Dougie Ford, the Premier of Ontario, who, wouldn't you know, has been in the news a little bit recently, Krista. Could you imagine that? What's this guy about? So there are many reasons to despise Doug Ford as a politician, and I would even say as a human being. You know, when I worked as a reporter at City Hall, he was one of the most personally, in my opinion, repugnant and repulsive human beings in that cadre of some really horrible human beings. Like, it was a slimy human being to talk to. It always just felt like he was, you know, trying to win you over. He was always politicking and always had the worst impulses at heart. He was able to propel himself to the premiership. He didn't win the mayoral race, which I still think, you know, sticks in his craw that he's never been the mayor of Toronto, even though John Tory gets to do it. And since,
well, it's like John Tory wanted to be premier and he wanted to be mayor, right? And they each got each other's jobs.
And they have that antipathy constantly because of that. But basically, we talked about before, Doug Ford's handling of the COVID crisis in Ontario, the vaccination rollout, the series of lockdowns, and opening up has been dismal. Earlier this week, he blamed our current situation on young people, basically saying that they're, you know, all going outside, they're not adhering to the rules, claiming that hospitalizations and ICUs are now more young people than any other demographic. That was proved to be entirely false. But the worst thing about all this is he's not suggesting that they are necessarily breaking the rules, because you can't say that, you know, outwardly. They are just doing exactly what has been allowed and forced by his government. And then now, especially today, Doug Ford spent extra time blaming young people for the predicament that we're in as the third wave of COVID is starting to hit the province where Christo and I currently reside. The hypocrisy of it all, the sickening way that this government is trying to represent a policy that you can't really understand, and then blaming the public for following that policy is just, I don't know, it's unheard of. I can't imagine anyone is buying what Doug Ford is selling currently. What do you think?
Well, I mean, he continues to poll well, right? Like, that's what's shocking about this, right? He continues to poll well. And I know polls aren't everything, and I know we're a long ways out from the next election, but, you know, he polls well. And so I think part of this is, you know, he has his base. His base is strong, that, you know, for whatever reason, he's been able to distance himself from the blame. Like, he's made mistakes, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of this, I don't know if you remember, Andy, but he told people to go on the March break.
Yeah, yeah.
He did, right? Yeah. And I know, look, a lot of us, you know, it was early in COVID and a lot of the science wasn't well known yet. We know that. But like, you know, other, he basically told people, don't worry, go on your trips, go travel. And then a couple days later, he had to pull that back. And who knows how many people ended up traveling because the premier said it was fine and like ended up getting COVID or ended up getting almost stranded somewhere wherever they went on their trip. Right. And so, you know, this like Ontario, like Quebec, were among the biggest failures in the nursing home crisis. He, you know, cut some of the inspections in nursing homes. He's done nothing to challenge the for-profit nursing home sector. But for whatever reason, he's not yet faced the political consequences for those actions. And again, like, you know, his polling, it's fairly constant. And that's showing that the coalition that put him into power in 2018 likely is remaining somewhat stable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm hoping at least that this flip-flop now could be something that penetrates that armor, because it right now, as of recording, it was just announced today on Thursday that Ontario is, like we said, going into a another lockdown. That means no indoor or outdoor dining, which was a big proponent of what the Ford government was pushing before, of trying to get outdoor dining working, even in the gray zones in Peel and Toronto area, where they've had, I think, as of now, 160 days in full lockdown, they still were trying to allow this outdoor dining. And like I said before, the sickening thing is we enter this third wave where the modeling suggests we could have 800 people a day in the ICU. Our current infrastructure can't handle that. You know, they're making tent hospital cities outside of Sunnybrook right now to prepare. But the Ford government, a week ago, 7 days ago, was saying that it's okay to go outside, was making special arrangements so that people could be on patios. And today, Ford spent all of his time blaming different mayors for pushing him to reopen, blaming, you know, unverifiable medical data from the experts of pushing him open, not taking responsibility for reopening and reclosing and allowing people to just follow the rules, and then being told that they're going to kill now not grandma and grandpa, but yourself.
Personal opinion, driving around, you know, a lot of people are gathering in larger groups. And at a point, Rob, when we did put the restrictions before, we did see it drop. We did see it go below 1,000. And I believe that if everyone just goes by the guidelines and the protocols laid out by the chief medical officer, we will see the numbers drop. We have no choice.
Because the shocking thing, the fear of the third wave is that it is much more deadly and damaging to younger individuals. So just that hypocrisy now of the challenges that we're facing is, I don't know, I don't see how anyone, like I said, can still stick with it now. Because if you are a member of Doug Ford's base, well, again, I doubt there's very little that we could ever agree on in that measure, besides maybe that Justin Trudeau is a snake. But I don't think that this back and forth half measure closures would ever be taken as a successful, you know, way to move forward. Like, I don't know how we can look at the half measures and what Ford has been doing now and think that, you know, he's doing a good job or that this would help anyone. Like, I don't know about you, but the inconsistency of understanding what is allowed and what isn't during these last 6 months has been shackling to at least me and my family and, you know, the people that we want to interact with, to understand, you know, what is safe to do, what are we allowed to do but isn't safe. And that lack of trust in the government has made me at least feel like they will always be a failure in this way. Like, I don't know, fundamentally we have to look at why he's doing this too, right? Why yeah. He's reopening. And we talked about it before. It seems like the simplest reason why, you know, January 1st, they didn't do just a full lockdown, you know, get federal aid to make sure that we get our essential services. It seems like the number one reason that hasn't happened in Ontario is because of capital, because people believe that even while every small business and restaurant is closed, which maybe that's the right thing to do, every distribution center and manufacturing service needs to be open and doesn't have to adhere to the necessary rules of other businesses. And it's so sickening to see people treated and put in danger for something that's so nebulous, you know, for the idea of, you know, the well-being of the economy. You know, we all must die for the altar of capital. I think that was actually a title of one of our previous episodes.
We've definitely used that phrase, yeah. You know, being sacrificed at the altar of capital. Yeah, no, 100%. And like, this is all on top of the fact that like Ontario has utterly failed with the vaccine. Like, look, I'm not an expert, and I'm sure that it's not as easy as you or I would make it out to be. But the fact of the matter is, like, we have situations where only people above 70 in many parts of the province, not everywhere. There's some pilot vaccination programs in pharmacies for people more in their late 50s, early 60s. But there are certain parts of the provinces where they have all these unfilled vaccination, you know, appointments, right? They have just dozens, if not hundreds, of spaces for people above 70 to go get a vaccine, and they're not going to get it for one reason or another, right? And the fact of the matter is, like, they're not able to get the vaccine out to people above 70, and they're not filling those time slots with younger people that may want the vaccine. And so, yeah, in Canada, we had issues at the federal level with procurement. You know, privatization of our vaccination facilities and our domestic pharmaceutical production. But this Ford government has utterly failed. They've totally failed to actually implement any sort of like commonsensical vaccination plan. And look, I know it's more complicated than that, but if you look across the border to New York State, they've basically opened up vaccination, or will be imminently, to everyone. And meanwhile, here in Ontario, for the most part, it's you have to be like an older boomer or older to get a vaccine or be, you know, in a certain profession.
Maybe Ford needs to be accused of sexual harassment, and that will force him to do like they did in New York State, because I'm pretty sure it was, you know, after Cuomo got his latest allegation, I think the press release came that day that, oh, wait, no, we're opening it up to 30 plus now. But yeah. It's funny you talk about vaccinations, because, of course, Ford was asked these questions over the last several weeks, and his answer across the board was that this is the federal government's fault. This is Justin Trudeau's fault, that he promised, you know, 6 million vaccinations by the end of March, and that didn't happen. And of course, Trudeau suggests otherwise and says that's not exactly true. You know, we do have the surplus in place. You're just not using it correctly. Like, the thing that always makes me laugh about Canadian politics is how much the party will follow the theater of the leader's insanity. So as Ford is touting this message that this is Trudeau's fault, and, you know, that they're hurting Ontarians, we had, I believe it's Stephen Leach, the education minister, saying that, you know, we set up this whole vaccination clinic at Wonderland the first day, and because of the federal government, we don't have enough, so we had to close it down the second day. And it's just like, it's clearly meant, why set it up then? Like, you can count more than one day. Like, there's no way you are this intentionally incompetent at a basic function of your job. It's just meant to be theater. And that's okay sometimes when we're not dealing with like a pandemic that leaves most people terribly sick and is ruining our lives in so many other ways. But just to see that politics is business as usual in Ontario is really, really disconcerting. And I don't know, this is, last week we had some bad feelings of discontent and disillusionment about our current situation, but now I'm feeling more fired up and enraged that still today, like I said before, Doug Ford spent a lot of time in the presser today trying to blame this on everyone else but himself, trying to say that, you know, it wasn't clear what the established understanding was from the medical community. When we have proof, we know that up to 3 weeks ago, there was already modeling that said this third wave is going to be one of the worst unless we shut down right away. And I don't know about you, but I do feel like we as a province and as a nation could have accepted a 2 month, 3 month, even full lockdown, if we really did believe that it would lead to normalcy in some way. But this idea of this piecemeal, a little bit locked down, some things aren't, you know, it seems to depend on how the economy is doing that day and what calls he got, you know, from what different CEOs will influence, you know, what's open and not. I feel like it's more maddening and dangerous than the very real medical and psychological toll of being locked down. Like, absolutely, that's a real thing. But what's even worse, we heard Ford today trying to reflect that as the reason. So not saying that it was because of, like, political reasons or, you know, that it's a need for our economy to move forward, but because it's for to help people's mental health was truly sickening. Like, that was the moment today when it was just, you know, you got to turn it off because you can't take it anymore. But he's using that card. He's using that language of something that is true to justify his really heinous mishandling of the COVID crisis in Ontario. So I'm not very hopeful for the future. Anything else to add to this shit show?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are legitimate criticisms you can make of the federal government if you're the provinces. I mean, the reality is that we have less vaccinations per capita, and that tracks in much of the country. And so, you know, maybe all the premiers are making mistakes, but at some point, if it's bad everywhere, it's the federal government's fault as well. But, like, again, Doug Ford has failed to get shots in arms. And predominantly, you know, while procurement is federal responsibility, distribution is provincial responsibility. And we've seen many cases of that. We see, for instance, that there was no pharmacy program opened up in Brampton or Mississauga, two of the hardest hit regions. There was nothing opened in those areas that could have been helpful to mitigate the spread. And those are high density, fast growing communities without enough hospital beds. You know, Brampton's famously a city significantly larger than Kingston, only has one hospital. Whereas here in Kingston, we have two. Kingston's got about 100, a little bit over 100. Brampton's pushing 600, I think, now. They're the Ford government has failed, and you can only do the musical chairs game of blaming the other jurisdiction so long.
Yeah.
And so far, it's paid off for him. Mm-hmm. Like, Doug Ford continues to pull well, but who knows how long that'll last.
Yeah, you know, I am hopeful that as we enter this another lockdown, like that we talked about the mental toll earlier, like I am hopeful that this will at least give people a really true sense of, you know, what these politicians are doing for us. But it just feels so calculated and not in a way to protect our well-being. It feels like it's calculated to ensure that these people in power are able to keep being in power without changing that much, without doing anything too drastic to shift the tides. And that is always the worst thing that a politician could do, is to not have, you know, some righteous belief of how they believe they can solve a problem and follow that up. Like, that is often the one of the biggest issues we bring up when we talk about politicians, is how piecemeal, how, you know, unapologetically neoliberal the thinking can be, when right now we need a big, perhaps unpopular decision so that we won't have to do another lockdown, you know, at the end of July, after we've locked down for another month. And unless we go for longer, based on the, you know, the expert Ontario data, it seems like that could happen again. So I'm very hopeful that this cycle won't continue, but I don't know. I don't know. How has the lockdown been for you, Christo?
It's not been too bad. I mean, I work from home, right? Like, these sorts of things affect me a little bit less. It was hard when Demetrios, my son, wasn't going to daycare, because it makes it so that you have to kind of do your work and do childcare and sort of jam it all in. But it's been hard, of course. You can't see your friends. You can't see your family. It's been challenging, but I know that I have a lot of privilege, given that I can work from home, to have the option to, haven't really seen a decline in income as a result of the crisis, which a lot of people can't say. So it's been hard, but I'm thankful that it hasn't been harder.
Yeah. And how is, I guess, the change hasn't been quite as impactful of the off and on sort of lockdowns with you, right? Of having, you know, yeah, because where I've been, we've been off and on so often that it's just, it is a toll. You know, my, as so many other people, my extended family and immediate family are in Toronto and Brampton. So that those are the most lockdown places in Ontario. And this back and forth way, this mishandling that Doug Ford and the federal government, but now Doug Ford is the loudest voice in this, have caused me and I think millions of other Ontarians a lot of suffering. And it's just not right. Like, that's not said enough. Like, this is wrong in a real tangible way. It's not just a politician being a politician. This is hurting Ontarians and it needs to stop now. And I don't think it will. So anything we can do to erode the Doug Ford base, I will always be on that side. But, you know, I like you said, he seems to be Teflon a little bit when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So next up, we talked about my vote for the worst Ontarian, I'm sorry, worst politician in Canada. Let's hit that drum roll one more time. Christo, who do you have for the worst Canadian politician this week?
Well, this week we got Adriana LaGrange. Now, this is a bit more of a deep cut. When we went with Doug Ford, we went with a friend of the show, for, you know, Doug Ford. But, but Adriana LaGrange, for those who don't know, is the Minister of Education in Alberta. And if you've been following this on Twitter, or if you're in Alberta, maybe you've been following it on Facebook, Alberta has sort of put out a new proposed social studies curriculum, but also some curriculum based in the science programs as well. They're doing a curriculum overhaul, and a lot of people, teachers, parents, decent human beings, are obviously very angry about some of the things in this curriculum, because it really is, in some places more explicitly than others, sort of trying to plant the seeds for a lot of right-wing talking points that are utterly not based in fact or science or respectable pedagogy, but are nonetheless crucial to the UCP, to the United Conservative Party, which is the governing party of Alberta, you know, one of the more right-wing governing parties currently in power in Canada. And so just a few examples. One, they have a section here where they talk about climate change, and they make it very clear that climate change can be caused by both humans and non-human activity. But there's no necessary assertion in the curriculum that what's happening now is undeniably human-made. That it is very true that in the broad scopes of this planet's history, before Homo sapiens and during our time here for the last couple hundred thousand years, climate change has often been driven by non-man-made processes. But in the last 200 years, and especially in the last generation or two, as humanity has gotten, you know, more and more populous, and as we've gotten more and more carbon intensive, it's undeniable that humans are causing climate change. And this sort of seems to be planting the seeds for a common right-wing talking point, as we talked last week, which is that some conservatives do not deny that the climate is changing, but deny what is causing the climate to change. Right? And if you give people the permission to say, okay, sure, maybe it's the factory, maybe it's the tar sand pools or what have you, but it could also be that, you know, the planet is just warming. The planet is just warming through natural processes that are bigger than any of us human beings, and there's nothing we can do about it, so we might as well just go on glugging oil, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and that's one of the arguments. Another one here is they talk about the history of the KKK in certain parts of Canada, which were more prominent in the West, and this is certainly an important part of history. But, you know, they sort of empathize with the KKK in a way, and really ask you, you know, not only where was KKK membership the highest, why did it find some support in Canada? Almost as if to say, you know, why was the KKK so appealing, right? Why was the KKK so appealing? And it's like, look, I get it. It's, it is not necessarily a deep-rooted defense of the KKK, like you might see, you know, from the Charlottesville rally, you know, a few years ago, you know, during the early days of Donald Trump. But it is, in a sense, like an attempt to rationalize. Sort of connected to that, they do a brief jump into American history and British history, talking about, you know, Canada's connection to the wider world. Again, that's fine, but they make it very clear. To talk about the role of slavery and how it shaped North America. And they say here, in understanding a grade 6 curriculum, the United States Congress, controlled by the Democratic Party, ruled in the Fugitive Slave Act that escaped slaves must be returned to their owners. And this is important because it does show, you know, the gradual development of the Civil War, that it like, you know, there were free states and there were slave states, and various laws passed at the federal level sort of drove those two sides into an eventual war that was probably inevitable in some way or another. But what it says here, in a sense, is it wants you to regurgitate that 2020-2021 Republican talking point, which is that fundamentally, it's the Democratic Party that's the party of the racists, right? This is a common refrain. And look, I'm not defending the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, especially as it pertains to foreign policy, often does practice things with a certain, you know, animus towards the global South, the global non-white populations. Don't get me wrong. But the fact of the matter is, like, Republicans will cite the fact that during the Civil War and during Jim Crow, many of the racist leaders were in the Democratic Party as a way to justify the fact that the Republican Party is not today racist, when of course it was overwhelmingly Republicans defending symbols like the rebel flag, like the stars and bars, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard Confederate flag, even though that was a symbol much more widely cherished by latter-day Democrats.
You know, it's
by
not Democrats the messaging not. Of what that information is trying to impart, right? Like, that's not what you should glean from that moment in history.
Irrelevant what the party's names were, especially in a grade 6 understanding. And again, these are very brief... these are very brief snippets, and so what you're getting is the broadest strokes. And so that if the broadest strokes is that you need to implicate the Democratic Party in slavery, which is to say, like, to all the kids in the room who will, you know, apply that to modern politics, it's just like a tool of soft propaganda. But one of the worst things comes with religion, and it sort of really does create this understanding that Christianity is the default set religion of Alberta and of Canada, and then there are others who are coming in, and we should respect our diversity, but also acknowledge that people are going to be weird about them, and we should also be respectful of that. And so I just want to read it here. This is a little bit more detailed. It says, the religious affiliation of most Albertans is Christian, and the largest denominations are Roman Catholic, United, Anglican, Lutheran, and Baptist churches. There is growing ethnic and religious diversity in the population. Canada and Alberta's latest census data on Alberta and Canada religious diversity. You can consult that. They recommend teachers do that. And then in the understanding section, it says, freedom of religious practice is encouraged, but acceptance comes less easily, in part because newcomers bring new and unfamiliar religious faith and practices. And so, you know,
holy shit. Like, that is unbelievable. I'm obviously not as familiar with the typical curriculum for elementary and, you know, the basic levels of education in our country, but that seems to be framed in only one way. Like, that seems where the intention, you're not even hiding behind a mask there. You're making it very, very clear that this is what you believe. And I don't know, that can't be typical across the board.
No, there's a reason why a lot of people are mad about this. Now, to be fair, what the Alberta government will say is they're not done the consultative process yet, blah, 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 blah. But, like, let's be clear. They put this out. These are not leaked. These are from the Alberta website. So they definitely felt that this was at least at a stage where they could show it to people. There's been insufficient consultation with teachers and parents, and a lot of people are angry about this, right? And like, look, again, now hypothetically, they have an out where they could say, well, actually, we encourage diversity. We tell people to look for diversity in their communities. But again, the message is clear, right? That there are the established, like, you know, not official like a state church, but the established default regular Canadian religions, which are basically Protestant and Roman Catholic Christianity. And then there's everybody else. They don't, the Jewish people, Sikhs, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, even other Christians that they might not mention potentially, you know, the fact of the matter is like, they basically say diversity is good, tolerance is good, but like people in those other groups, those quote unquote new and unfamiliar groups, need to recognize that acceptance comes less easily because newcomers will be seen as unfamiliar and weird, basically, right? They don't use the word weird. They say new and unfamiliar, but that's what they're trying to argue, right? They're trying to argue in a sense that there's like the default Canadians aren't necessarily going to be ready for you folks. And so like, well, you're welcome to Canada. Like maybe eventually you won't be weird and unfamiliar and you can be in group one, right?
Yeah, like, you're a default really Canadian. Tweet. The idea, even that whole premise of being a default Canadian, like it's just, it's so, again, sickening to see an arm of our system of society being used as propaganda, like so fundamentally in such a basic way. Like, do you remember in Ontario the outrage when they wanted to adapt the sex education curriculum from like a 1993 so that young
which was
people
perfectly reasonable. Yeah, I hated so much about that Wynne government, but there was nothing wrong with that program from my perspective.
Yeah, it was teaching consent to people that were in grade school and understanding about like online predators and how that all works. But the antipathy and the hate that was pushed from the conservative base to fight against that because it was seen as even close to propaganda, that this wasn't just about education, was deafening. And a lot of, you know, it was a huge battle for this that government there that, like you said, wasn't great, but was at least trying to do something good. How is it possible that in Alberta, that this is so obvious, just an expression of propaganda by one wing of the government? How is this not, you know, fired down with lightning bolts, essentially?
Well, I mean, they are getting hammered right now, right?
Yeah.
Like, they are getting hammered. There's a reason we're talking. Yeah. There's a reason she's the worst person of the week, right? Because this became a national story because of this, right? Like, you know, the fact of the matter is, like, people are hammering it. The NDP, of course, the local NDP government is hammering this. There was a, Rachel Notley said that effectively she's the Alberta NDP leader, former premier, current leader of the opposition, basically saying that this is, whether intentional or not, it creates an othering of non-Christians and sort of makes them feel like they are not welcome in the province, they are not welcome in their community, or at the very least, insofar as they are welcomed, it is due to the benevolence, right? And even regular folks, this is a lawyer here who is from, who I believe is from Alberta, or at least from Canada, and she says Muslims have been in Canada since 1871, Sikhs, 1897, Hindus, 1911. These are probably the earliest verifiable dates. For all we know, people from all those faiths have been here even longer. We are not newcomers. We are not unfamiliar. We are your neighbors, friends, farmers, teachers, fellow citizens. We are not others, right? And this is underlined by the fact that they do have a specific program here where they teach people about the main beliefs and ideas of Christianity. And now look, I'll clarify, and maybe not all our listeners will agree, maybe you don't even agree. I actually have no issue with religion being part of social studies curricula, because the fact of the matter is religion remains a deeply important part of Canadian society, right? Whether people want it to be or not, religion is unavoidable, right? And so I think it's good to teach people in as even-handed a manner as possible what the beliefs and principles are of major religions, and I think, and maybe this is maybe me being a propagandist myself, underlining the very broad similarities that most of the world's major religions have, which basically amounts to, don't be a dick, right? You know what I mean? And so I think it's actually a great opportunity to build some of that solidarity by teaching, say, you know, the commonalities between all of these religions. But they say here, they have a section, Christianity's principal teacher, teachings Jesus Christ is the Son of God, this Trinity, Sermon on the Mount, talk about the New Testament, talk about the crucifixion, heaven and hell, talk about some of the parables. And then, you know, students should be able to describe what Christianity is. Now, there's no indication on the website that they will do this for other major religions. And that is a problem, right? It is a problem, even if you're teaching it in an academic fashion, which is possible, you are in effect teaching people about the main religious tenets of Christianity, but not of other major faiths and very quickly growing faiths in Canada. And this is to say nothing of the fact that none of these things have necessarily referenced indigenous spirituality and even other smaller religions.
Yeah,
as
that's
well,
what
right?
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Like, considering the legacy of genocide in the West in particular, and the current, you know, just complete victimization of Native populations there. From what you've seen so far, is there any indication of, you know, what the curriculum, how they're going to touch on Native issues in the province?
I haven't seen anything on that regard yet.
Maybe that's even more insidious and they're just trying to get this stuff out first to deal with.
Yeah.
I can't imagine if they're presenting this as a propaganda arm that, you know, maybe you should be more critical of climate change. And remember, the Democratic Party had a lot to do with slavery. And of course, Christianity is great and new religions are a little bit different. And we should remember that. I can't imagine they're going to have positive things to say about what the Canadian government and the Alberta government has done to Native populations over the last 200 years.
So there is some reporting from Global. They've talked to a couple professors who have talked about this. I haven't seen the actual links as I have on Facebook and Twitter about the actual PDFs of and you know, JPEGs of the curriculum there. But basically, the argument from a lot of professors that they've talked to in Alberta at the UFC, University of Calgary, and University of Alberta, is that the curriculum is very celebratory of Canadian history. And that, of course, almost invariably leads to the sort of invisibility of Indigenous suffering, right? That's almost a given, right? So, for instance, it notes here, Yvonne Poitras-Pratt, a University of Calgary associate professor who specializes in Indigenous education, says the curriculum is a perfunctory nod to broader First Nation culture while focusing on its role in the European migration. What I see in K-6 is very much a celebratory story about the colonial side of our history, where the Indigenous people are more of an add-on to this broader colonial story.
Oh my God, just that line, the celebratory side of our colonial history.
Like, so that's her characterization of it. But I think she's suggesting is, if I can paraphrase, is that it might celebrate the hardy, industrious, innovative pioneers, and, you know, from whether they're from Western Europe or whether they could talk about the Ukrainians and all these sorts of things, and say that they took this hardy, you know, rough, undeveloped land and turned it into a country, which is very much rooted in this idea that the land was empty or was not being utilized. There were either nobody here or nobody worth talking about, or they were there, but they were just wasting the land, and so we made it productive.
Thank God the Ukrainians came and saved the land that wasn't being used. So we don't know yet, but my God, that sounds sickening.
It says here, it's like, if you think of the Métis, for instance, there's none of the inclusion of the ways in which the script process was flawed, in which lands were taken away. So there's not really much about, like, the dispossession of Indigenous people. Dwayne Donald, a University of Alberta associate professor of education, focusing on Indigenous curriculum. So these are deep experts here. We're not just making this up, right? Donald said, in the proposed curriculum, the Indigenous experience seems bolted onto a timeline, a box to be checked off. the Indigenous experience suffuses the North American experience, he said, and the curriculum needs to draw on that accumulated wisdom and worldview. He's like, there is this moral success story the curriculum designers want to tell, and the story is based on how liberal democracy coupled with market capitalism morphed together to create the most successful societies the world has ever seen. But of course, all of that, at least in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, United States, all of our hemisphere in some way or another, is rooted on the genocide of Indigenous people. Whether literal genocide, like, you know, physical genocide, cultural genocide, often both. I mean, like, there is tons of research done on how through residential schools, but also literal purposeful starvation, the plains were quote-unquote cleared for European settlers and European railways. There's old Canadian money, Andy, I don't know if you ever, of like the showing a train moving from east to west. And as the train moves from east to west, you can see Indigenous people running away from the progress. There's also art of the United States, right? Where like Lady Liberty moves across the vast continent and bringing light. And as she moves, you see trains and you see farms and you see towns. And then in the darkness fading away, you do see Indigenous people again riding away. And this is a common trope that Indigenous people are either irrelevant to the story or...
an impediment, yeah.
Yeah, an impediment in yeah. a sense, right? Yeah.
And, well, and that we were even thinking of that, too, when we were trying to, you know, come up with some very deliberate Canadiana imagery when looking for Left Turn Canada. You pointed out, like, we have an artistic culture of attributing this loss to just the majesty of nature, not actually recognizing that, like you said, these lands are empty because of a systemic planned march to get rid of people that most of Canadians at that time saw as lesser. And like he also pointed out there in the expert that you had, that these are perhaps a celebration of capitalism and liberal democracy. If we're looking at how our country and those countries are doing right now, there's not really a celebration. We're at the brink because of this pandemic. And this idea that, like, maybe now when we're constructing curriculum, maybe we should be a little more critical of our history, of what led us to, you know, these gross inequalities that we deal with today. That's not even being brought up. But we will make sure that kids know that the Democratic Party had a lot to do with KKK and the slavery and slavery in America. So it's just, I don't know, it's again, deeply disturbing. But as someone who's been in education, Christo, for a real long time, went through that cycle. I have a lot of friends and family that have done the same thing. And the difficulty, the tedium of a lot of that can be hard. But this has got to hit home, right? Because this is about education. This is about trying to inspire young people to take similar paths that you and your colleagues did.
Yeah, I mean, look, the reality is that education is essential, and what you teach children and what you don't teach children matters, right? Like, there's other reporting here by Global that the Métis Nation of Alberta has monumental concerns with the curriculum. It's very much a Eurocentric, you know, North American sort of history. The Métis are not included in any meaningful way. It's a colonial practice. And again, this is important because education in this country, in these lands, has historically and still to this day been used as an essential tool of genocide, right? Education can be a tool of genocide. The residential schools, which again, the last one closed, Andy, when you and I would have been of school age. It's conceivable that you and I would, if we were Indigenous and lived in the relevant communities that were still under the, you know, the jurisdiction of those schools, we could have been old enough to have attended a residential school. Most of them were closed by then, but the last ones closed in the 1990s. Right? It is not it is a enduring part of our history. And so fundamentally, education, and again, what you teach and what you don't teach, what you allow to be learned, what you don't allow to be learned, is essential to society building and society destroying. And so again, one of the professors we quoted, I believe, it says here, where is that?
Where is that?
I want to get the quote.
Yeah, let's get the good
quote right. But it says here, there's a quote here where it says, this is another example of Alberta's continual colonial practice over Métis people. The act of the program being designed as such is part of the colonialism. So it's not just colonialism in that these things happened in the past and there hasn't been reckonings. It's not even just colonialism in the fact that the program fails to really mention the contributions and complexities of Indigenous people and of other minorities, past, present, and future, but also that, like, in the consultative process, clearly Indigenous people were not meaningfully included. And so, look, I don't have much more to say on this, but the program is crap, and Albertans from a whole bunch of backgrounds do not like it. This government has a majority, but they are quickly losing popularity. Unlike in Ontario, where Ford has been able to really hold on, the polling in Alberta has really tanked for the Conservatives there. If an election was happen today, the Alberta NDP would storm back to power with a fairly comfortable win. So maybe they'll go back to the drawing board on this one, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, it's deeply upsetting to see. Like you said, this continue to be a tool of Canadian colonialism that so ravaged this country for so long, and education as a legacy being used for that way. I don't remember the first time that I heard the word communist or socialist in my years of education that wasn't deeply enshrouded in evil enemy and representative of everything that was wrong. Like I have such in every subject, it didn't matter what it was. And of course this doesn't compare at all to the legacy of destruction.
No, you and I are still white European Canadian men, right?
Yeah, of course.
Even people that are very much part of every sort of mainstream metric, you know, being a man, being, you know, not having disabilities, not, you know, all these things, you can still feel very othered from your educational platform, and the propaganda can still affect you, right? That's perfectly reasonable to note, I think.
And it's just, it is shocking. All of this stuff is shocking, but we heard today about their plans for, you know, how they're going to educate the youth, but we didn't take enough time to talk about it. The idea that in Alberta, they're not making it very clear the established understanding of climate change on the planet, that we have reached or are reaching a point of no return for change to happen now, or we could have, you know, apocalyptic conditions in the next, not 100 years, but in the next 25 years, in the next 30 years, is like a miscarriage of justice. Like, this is wrong in a way that will continue to hurt people, because like you said, it gives them that antecedent, right? It gives them just that little thing that people can cite as an alternative their education. And we talked about it a couple episodes ago. Like, when it comes to climate change, there's no need to parse things or to be considerate or to even worry that much, in my opinion, about public opinion, because the truth is very self-evident. And when our education fails to capture that, there is literally no point in talking about climate change in an education setting or even as a politician, unless it's followed with there needs to be dramatic, like, eco-socialism right now, or we're all going to die, or more likely, you know, certain people are going to become even more exorbitantly rich, and all of our lives are going to get steadily worse and worse and worse. And to see now, when their kids being taught that, you know, maybe the Industrial Revolution didn't, you know, have anything, had something to do with it, but isn't everything, even though it was like 200 times the emissions in 5 years after the 1800s and exponentially worse each, you know, decade part. I don't know. I don't know where you move or convince someone like that to get to a position that they have to be. You know, like, that path to me seems unattainable.
Yeah, and I mean, look, maybe that's why they're trying to get children. I mean, children's brains are very malleable, right? In a lot of good ways. I mean, look how easily children can learn things compared to old people like us, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that if you can plant these seeds, even if they're not as explicit as conservatives would like them to be, about diversity and tolerance and how white Europeans built this country and how it's their country first and foremost. Others are allowed to come, but you know, this is a white European country. These sorts of things, even if you don't always say them explicitly, will lodge into people's brains. And once people get older and what have you, it's hard to get those things out.
Yeah. So again, thank you for listening and spending some time with us this week. I know it's hard out there. In both of the instances today, when we brought, you know, the absolute worst politicians of this week, I think the good thing is there is a loud visual majority, and maybe not majority, but there's a loud fight against both of these people and the parties they represent to stop them for destroying our lives. So it's not as if I think they're a little more mask off with a lot of this stuff, which I think is probably beneficial to trying to move the needle a little bit. Although if they're that comfortable to be this mask off in a crisis that we just you can see pretty clearly, you know, their nefarious intentions, maybe that's not a good thing. I'm not 100% on that. Which do you think it's good that we're seeing these politicians be so like obvious in their evil? Or is that, you know, a case for a time that we have not had yet?
I'm not sure. I get what you're saying, that you know it's good. It's good in a sense because people can see them for what they are. Maybe it makes it easier to expose them. But again, that could indicate a comfort with being like that. Sort of like how Republicans in the United States have been increasingly racist. Is that a sign that it makes it easier to expose them in some ways? Donald Trump being so mask off led to more people than ever coming out to vote against him. But it's also the case that them being like that is an indication that politicians feel that there are not going to be sufficient electoral consequences for them doing this as they maybe thought there once was. I don't know what the ultimate answer is, but it's concerning nonetheless.
Yeah. So again, stay strong out there. If you have a chance to, if it's within your means, please do contribute to our Patreon. Excited to see all y'all talk about this stuff on Discord, because it's such a, you know, an hour is not enough time for a lot of this. It's so meaty. It's so contextual. There's so many different things that are involved with our Canadian landscape and how it changes. But I do think these two issues today are going to be with us for a long time. So again, contribute Left Turn Canada on Patreon. That's all for me. Anything else you got, Christo?
Nope. This was great. Thanks so much, guys. And love having you listen every week, and looking forward to more and more people joining this community.